What is author marketing mastery through optimization, you ask? I'm going to tell you. It's the best way for us authors to make a living selling our books. Are you tired of hearing gurus tell you your book is only good enough to be a lead magnet for services? Are you tired of feeling like you have to be a slave to social media and then frustrated when the time you spend doesn't actually help you sell books? I was too, until I found Ammo. Ammo is the only program that reliably produces results, and it works for anyone. Is it hard work? You bet. Do you have to overcome some of your own prejudices to make Ammo work for you? Absolutely. But rather than being another program that rah-rah shishkoom boss tries to get you emotionally excited only to offer unclear methods, Ammo shows you how to design profitable ads step by step through a unique, highly tested and targeted formula. The founder, Steve Piper, is a data-loving, formula-driven author who escaped the kingdom of Amazon to build a platform for himself, where he sold directly to his readers and built a loyal following and millions of copies sold. With Ammo, you know who's reading your books, how to contact them, and what they want to read next. If you've always been frustrated with Amazon's wall of mystery of not knowing who's reading your books and losing 50 to 70% of your hard-earned money that you're making through sales, Ammo solves all of those problems by putting you in the driver's seat and showing you how to fulfill your books directly to your readership. Click the link in the show notes to learn more.
This one has been a long time coming, guys, and I am so excited to present it to you. There needs to be more voices like this on TRBM because one of the areas where we pigeonhole ourselves, back ourselves into a corner, is that we don't listen to the rest of the business community when it comes to marketing our work. And yeah, I agree with you. Book marketing is a unique thing. In many cases, and especially with the people that I typically am talking to, the thing you're marketing is the end product. So we're all familiar with the podcasts where people talk about using a book as a lead magnet to get people into a services business, an e-commerce business of some kind, even sometimes like a fitness and training kind of a company. But that doesn't change the fact that the same core values that work for all marketing still work for book marketing. There's some tweaks we need to make, but listening to the wider, broader community is where we're going to find a lot of success. And so I am super excited with this interview. The guest name is Brandon Peterson. He is currently the chief executive officer for GeoKey Incorporated. He has 7 years of experience as a COO, full-time employee, and a board director for DPA. He is also related to me through my wife. He is my wife's cousin. And so a great opportunity to talk to somebody who has an amazing amount of experience in the business industry and talk to him about the sorts of things that he does to market. One of my favorite aspects of this conversation is we talk about employees. If you're an author right now, you probably don't often think of yourself as somebody who is going to eventually be retaining employees. But more and more, we're seeing the self-publishing industry move toward needing a whole team built up around you. That includes somebody who can help you with certain elements of marketing. That includes editors. That includes artists, cover designers, layout, format, all the kinds of things that you might want to outsource. And I know for me, I've been thinking a lot about these aspects. There's also somebody to manage your social media. The list goes on and on. Brandon and I are going to touch on all of these things and weave in and out of marketing in a generalized sense and then a very specific sense on book marketing. I put his feet to the fire and asked him, what would you do to market a book? You're going to be really excited to hear his answers. Before we dive in, this is the longest episode that I've done on TRBM in quite a long time, so feel free to break it up into several sittings if you want, but the one thing I would encourage you is listen all the way to the end, because we actually broke it up into two sittings, and so the conversation does not by any means get tired. It keeps this great intensity, and I'm really pleased to share my guest, Brandon Peterson.
This is TRBM Ammo Edition. If you're a published author and want to make a living writing books, and selling them to avid readers, you've come to the right place. There's simply no program that's more successful at driving readers towards the books you've written. So the only thing you have to worry about is writing a great book. And the system with Enamo takes care of the rest. Thanks for listening to this conversation.
If you go in with the mentality of, I have to have this, I have to have this, you probably will not get it. So you have to completely flip your mind shift. That's not that I don't have to have this. I want to have this, but I want even more than that, to give something to them, to create a relationship that can could keep on giving to myself and to them. And if you go in with that kind of mentality, it completely changes the dynamic of the conversation.
When I was young, probably somewhere in like the 10 to 12 range, my parents had a piano, and I used to sit down and kind of just play what appealed to me and the sounds that I liked. And I remember my stepmom telling me that she thought, you know, like, sounded really nice what I was playing. And so she wanted to get me lessons, and I took piano lessons for a while, and that sort of crushed my desire to do music. It was so formulaic. But then I kind of had a revival, because every guy does, like, they want to play guitar because, like, girls love guitar or whatever, you know. And all along the way, like, there was never quite a connection between rhythm and music for me. So I can actually make pleasing sounds, just not in a timed way that makes sense to people. So, like, I can listen to a song and I cannot hear the moment when I'm supposed to start singing. I Pearl Jam's my favorite band, and I can listen to every song. I know all the words, but I can never start when Eddie Vedder starts singing. Like, I'm always too early or just a moment too late. I can't hear timing. You are talking about this idea of offering something. And I'm wondering, do you think everybody thinks that way? Or is there ever a sense of, like, maybe your desire to honor a person is the gift? I'm doing a bad job of asking this question, but it's actually a serious one, because I know at least one person who's listening right now is feeling the same way I am, which is, I literally don't think I have anything to give you, Brandon, personally. I don't. I never have. I've always thought that anytime I reach out to you personally, that I am only gaining something from our interactions. But I also am strangely interested in you. I would love to just hear you tell me about your life and your family and your businesses. And I would spend all the time at a holiday listening to you, because I'm very interested in you and as a person. So I'm hoping I'm painting a constellation right now of, like, sometimes it's not altruism, and sometimes it's also not selfishness. You on this podcast right now are going to offer something to my listeners. I doubt I'm giving you very much in return, but you have my utmost respect and admiration. Can you talk a little bit about what you're hearing in terms of that, and maybe throw back another constellation of your own, or respond to that idea?
Yeah, completely. Well, I appreciate that. I'm thankful for you and the kind words that you said to me, but that I don't view it in that context of, like, you have nothing to give to me. I think giving doesn't have to be, you know, monetary or even tangible in the moment. You know, a gift can be something, it could be a word, it could be a feeling, it could be, and it could just be a new idea. And that has longevity. And if you really think of it in this context, which I'm about to tell you, things look a little different. So the way I see things is through in a very servant-minded context. I try to just let it be known that I'm here to give to you, even if I can't give right now. Okay. Listen, when I do mentorship, and this is just an example, just one example of mentorship. If I'm teaching somebody something, and I tell them this advice because I got burned by it, or it was a pain point for me or some sort, and they don't take that advice, I'm a little hurt. I'm a little like, okay, you don't value me. It was a gift if you take my advice and you go see success. That to me was, I gave time for you to have success, and I'm helping you in that process. That's a gift. That was giving. And even things like that, knowing someone's going to be, hey, I might not have anything monetary to give at this point in time to you, but I hope you know that if at any point in time you did need something from me,
yeah,
I am here for that. And that knowing that you have that security in a person is big. So it's really, it's not, I think people get really tied up on what I can give to you right in this moment. And I know in like a sales pitch or something, you want to offer that. But the reality is if you just go in with an open heart and servant minded, and you're saying, hey, you've got something that being transparent, you've got something that I really want.
Yeah.
I don't know if I can return the favor right now, but I hope you know that I'm willing to, and I want to.
Yeah.
And tell me what that entails.
And that I'm the kind of person who eventually is going to get there too. I think that's a really big piece of what you actually just said, is like, you almost took for granted the fact that maybe today you don't have a company the size of Google, but you actually feel, and with good reason, that soon you will have a company the size of Google. And so maybe you can't do a favor today, but maybe in 2 years you can do something like that. I like it because it's not exactly like the mob, you know, where you're like, hey, I'm going to do you a favor, you know, like, always remember me, buddy. But it also is something that ties back into that idea of understanding your value and understanding the journey you're on. You must have people reach out to you regularly that would love to freeload. And so I'm curious, what are the kind of things that are big red lights for you with freeloaders?
I think it depends on the context, right? If it's like somebody asking for advice or somebody's wanting to partner, first and foremost, it's like, sure, let's entertain what this would look like. You know, let's have a conversation.
Yeah.
For me, I have to have alignment, alignment in values, alignment in future vision, alignment in maybe they don't have a past of like, yes, I've grown these businesses or that, but I have a past of perseverance. Like,
yeah.
Okay. That's alignment to me. And so, if we don't line up in those, and I have a series of certain questions that I ask to get to that point, then it's, hey, listen, we're going to be wasting each other's time and respecting that. It's like, do I hate you? No. Are we going to waste each other's time? I believe we will.
For sure. Yeah. You mentioned earlier, this idea of like giving advice and, how if someone doesn't take it, that it almost wounds you. And I thought that was funny because, well, not funny. I thought it was notable because I have a very close friend. And for years and years and years, I have had some successes that are right in his strike zone. And I'll tell him, this is how you do it. This is what you do. Just do this and you'll be okay. And then he doesn't do it. And it makes me angry. And sometimes I'm like, oh, I don't know if it's worth carrying on here. You have leveled up a lot of times over the past 5 or 6 years, honestly, maybe even a shorter time frame than that. When do you decide that person who doesn't take your advice but still wants to be in your sphere is maybe just a good memory and not part of your future? Because I think that that's important.
Yeah. So this is a methodology I took from Bob Beal. Bob Beal went into churches and he helped build them up and taught a lot of leadership. So what he did is he kind of changed how he does a PIP, performance improvement plan, for like staff. And I'll just talk to it about employee staff, but it is transferable into other relationships in your life. We took that and we switched it into what's called a growth and development plan, a GDP. And so we based it off of Bob Beal's leadership star. So I would say a scenario would go like this. Jody, I care about you a lot. You are amazing. You do this really well, X, Y, Z. You really care about people and you do this part of your job really well. However, I need to be really honest with you because I do care about you. These areas you're not doing well and it's causing stress. You've got to be feeling it. This is stress to you. Causing stress to me. And to be honest, it's causing stress around this circle, around our ecosystem. So really, first and foremost, I just want to address that. Like, did you know that that was happening? And then you would say yes or no. And then I'd say, okay, so I want to come up with a solution with you today to get over this. And we're going to do it together. And I think it's really important for us to go together. And at that point in time, right there, is where you figure out your fork in the road. Mm. So if they say, I'm ready, I'm willing, I want to get over this bridge, I know that you're coming out of a place in your heart of care, not out of hate, or, you know, really just you want done with me. Or they're going to go, I don't see it and I can't get over it. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So if it's that direction where they're like, it's not going to happen. Okay. No problem. No problem at all. Now in the business world, we would say, okay, well, I'm going to pay you to go find your new job, that would be the severance. I'm going to pay you and you agree on what that looks like.
Get your ass go out find of your here.
New job. Get out of here. And I care about you enough for you to go do that. Cause this just isn't the right place. We're just not going to get aligned. The other side is, I'm so grateful for you. Thank you so much. And this can be transferable, like I said, into friendships, into family. I think let's take family, for example, you can't fire your family. However, what you can say is, hey, I have a boundary for my life because I have told you time and time again that this has put a lot of stress on me. Mm-hmm. And if we're ever going to have a conversation about this again, I'm drawing my line there. You don't take my advice. You don't respect my part of this, but I want to continue to love you. I just have to draw a line at this part.
Yeah.
Cause we're just not going to be aligned on it. And so if you take that, if you remove that issue from the person itself, it makes that relationship so much better.
Yeah.
And so it's a really hard thing to do because it's emotional, but if you can remove that and just face that one thing and draw lines where it's at or draw resolutions, then it's easier. So going full context into or full circle into, if I offer someone advice, how many times did I offer it? Have I had the true conversation with them? Have we tried to resolve it? If not, then we just have to, our resolution may just be, we're going to move on from each other, or we're going to move on from this part of our life.
It brings me to this thought process of the typical person. And I can say this based on research, the typical person does not want to end relationships. And so people will hold on to unproductive relationships for a long time. I have also been part of what I would consider business relationships. So you mentioned church. I was a Bible study leader for a long time of a fairly large group in a fairly small church. So I think I was a Bible study leader for 15% of the church. And it was really cool. It was a fun time. Met my wife there. When I communicated it was time for me to step back and do some different things for a little while, I kind of said, let me get my footing. Let me figure out my life in this huge period of transition. The pastor who had been mentoring me all that time immediately went from I'm available to you whenever to we're not going in the same direction anymore. I'm done with you. And at the time I was deeply hurt by that because I thought I maybe needed 6 months to a year to just sort of get my footing. And now you're done with me. I think that goes into the same conversation. We're going to take a step back after this question to talk about why this has anything to do with book marketing, because it absolutely does. But I would love to hear from you about those moments in a business where you have somebody who you can tell, they hit a moment, they're having a thing. How do you deal with somebody if you know they have all the raw skills, they have all the ability, but they're going to be a little bit of dead weight for a minute? Do you have patience with them, or do you just say hey, this is life, we got to go separate directions? What are your thoughts there? It's a tough one.
It depends where they're at. Yeah, it's a tough one because this isn't a cookie cutter response. So it depends on the mission ahead at that point in time. Is it time sensitive? Is it not time sensitive? If it's time sensitive, then that's kind of your core requirements of do we check these boxes? And no, we don't. So there from there. If it's not time sensitive, what I always go back to is is the drive there? Is the drive, do they want it? What we do with, we follow the book Traction. It's the entrepreneurial operating system.
Okay.
So we grade people on GWC. Do they get the job? Do they want to do the job? And can they do the job? Do they have the skills to do the job? And we will grade them on those things. Do they get the job? Yes. Do they want the job? Yes. Can they do the job? Do they have the skill sets? Maybe not. But they get it and they want it. So it's okay, Now, I've had people, we also grade on the core values of the business as well. So they get the job, they want the job, and they can do the job, but they don't match the core values. I've let people go. Top performers, by the way. And it's because, yes, are they doing the job really well? Yes.
Yeah.
Are they affecting other people in this business, on this team, that's making them do not as well inherently as a toxic, you know, if they're kind of toxic?
I love to remove it. I actually love this because I think I should probably be fired several times for want the job. I very frequently get the job and can do the job, but I very rarely want the job. When you're talking about the W-2 world, like I probably am looking to exploit every loophole I can to like be successful, but I don't really often buy into someone else's mission. So don't hire me if I ever apply for any of your companies.
Well, it doesn't mean you haven't wanted the job yet. It's just right around the corner, right?
Yeah.
So that's what, you know, I think you bring up a really good point there is that I'm saying this from one side of the coin, but there's another side of the coin and grade yourself. You know, do I get this job? Do I really want this job? Can I do this job? Do I align with the core values? Okay. If I do, but I just don't want it, what can make me want it? Go talk to someone in management and say, listen, this is what motivates me and this would make me want this job. I just want to be transparent with you.
Yeah. We're going to take a brief tangent, I guess. There's a guy out there. I'm sure you know of him just because he's all over social media. His name is Grant Cardone. I learned a tremendous amount from him about real estate investing, and largely from him, I built up a portfolio of real estate that was worth a little over $1 million. It's allowed me to kind of not coast, but use saved up money in order to do what I'm doing right now. And I'm really, really grateful for him. There have been times where I've been tempted to drop what I'm doing and go down to Florida and work for him. I know that if I were to just pick up everything and go, like I'm the kind of guy who could get a job from him. At the same time, I follow the path logically just a little bit further downstream, and I start to understand I will be bitter at Grant himself for making me serve his mission and not my mission. I've become enamored with the idea that everybody should own their own business, and I'm having this reflective point where I'm realizing guys like you, guys like me, we're a little bit unique. We have this desire to build something very big. You could even say we're like in like empire builders, and there's nothing wrong with that. But talk to me a little bit about that idea of, do you see people ever come through who you know have the can do and that part, but like don't maybe believe in your mission that you say, come on, you're going to be with me for a year. I'm going to teach you some stuff and you're going to go, but you're going to be like a fucking firecracker while you're here. And I'm willing to take that. Are there ever moments you have that?
Yeah, totally. Okay. Yeah. So one thing that we do, and I do this with every single new employee that comes on, is I ask them about their North Star. So I ask them a series of 4 questions to figure out their North Star. And I only give them a minute to answer. Why were you put on this earth? What do you want to see? What do you want to accomplish? What do you want to do with your life? How are you going to do that? And what's your legacy? So when you're dead and gone, you know, you have 1 minute to write your eulogy. And so based off of that, I figure out a lot about them. And some of them are like, I want to grow my own business. Some are like, I need a paying job because I want to support my family. Some are like, I want to go on vacations. I want to travel. I want to do this. And I need something to support that. Because the one thing I tell every single person that comes in is like, you are not born for this company. A job is a vehicle to get you to your goals. It's a platform. It's a vehicle to whatever you want to do. Buy your loved ones more gifts, go on vacation, support your family. Or maybe it's like us where we're entrepreneurs and it's like, no, we're born for that, you know, and not everybody is born for that. Just like I'm 5'5". I'm not born to be a basketball player. It's like, I just know, even though I can dribble a ball pretty good, Allen Iverson. but the reality is that's not what I was born to do. And so where we have that itch, go for it. And if there's any of your listeners listening to it right now, and it's like, you have that itch, do it now. Like just do it because you'll grandpa always says you'll never lose it all, you know? So just make sure your values are there. You're still taking care of your family, so on, whatever it is, but just make the jump. and try it. But if you don't have the itch, that's okay too. I call the people who come in to our company who are like, I have the entrepreneurial itch, but I just am not that. I'm not the founder. Like I don't got that itch.
Okay.
I'm like, you're an intrapreneur.
Okay.
Find a startup, be the integrator, be the second in command, the third in command, the fifth, tenth hire, whatever it may be. You're still going to get those entrepreneurial conversations, decisions, and so on, but it's a half bet. And you can still be just as passionate and be just as excited. And that's cool too. There's, like I said, it's no cookie cutter thing. It's no one size fits all.
Yeah.
These are all different options for you. And there's opportunities through each door that you choose.
Yeah. What I really love about what you just said is you immediately exposed to me a side of this that I had not thought about before. And that is building out your business and realizing that there are actually people who are happiest being in a supporting role to a really big dream. I don't know if you're this way. I actually get the idea you're not from our conversation. I have a hard time sometimes realizing that other people are not like me. And so sometimes I'm assuming, okay, my brain is going from the minute I wake up until the minute I go to sleep. And so I assume everybody else is that way. Everybody else is thinking the whole time. Then I talk to my wife and she's like, no, actually, there's a lot of time where I'm just not really thinking about anything. And you're like, what? How can you not think about something? And, you know, there's people who want a good job. I have a good friend named Brian Switters. All his life, all he wanted was to have a job where the employer treated him well and rewarded him for hard work. And unfortunately, he got burned a lot of times in his career because he worked hard. He deserved things and he didn't get them because he was the kind of guy who didn't demand. He just wanted to be recognized for getting out there and doing. But he was always hard for me to understand because I was like, no way, man. I'm working so hard. Like I want to spin off a new business. I want to learn something. I want to build. I want to create. It's really hard to understand that there are people for other roles. And so this is the last question that is not specifically book marketing. What I want to know from you is how do you determine when you are speaking to somebody who really fits a role versus if I were to come in an interview, my belief is, and this is just based on statistics, I can most likely get the job from you because I know what you want to hear. And so I can sort of chameleon myself into that role. If I get the interview, I get the job. That's typically how it goes. But I probably suck at that role. Like for the most part, how do you tell that somebody's the right fit to move your company forward, to move your mission forward?
Anybody who says that they are good at hiring is a liar.
Right.
No one knows. And so what you do is you take a bet. Hey, I like you. I feel like we align on core values. And you can ask questions that are like, hey, are you more of a lone ranger? If your core values like servant minded, are you more of a lone ranger? Or are you like a team oriented person? So then you can have that conversation like, okay, what side of the fence do they land on? Do they land on my values? They hit all those. Do they have a little experience? Bring them in. You know, we'll test it out. It's setting those expectations in the first week, month, 60 days that you realize, okay, they can do it or not. And then it's just being quick to saying, hey, you're missing your mark here. You have to hit your marker. You know, we got to make some changes.
Yeah. See, that's the interesting part. I worked for a company called Applied Underwriters, sold insurance. And really, probably the only sign that they could have seen that I was not a great employee was that I fought with my boss a fair amount until I taught my boss how to deal with me. And I say that really to be humbled because I sucked at learning how to work for him. I made him adjust to me. But I sold the shit out of insurance and I beat every metric that there was. You can't fire me because I didn't perform, but you probably should fire me because I don't listen. I do things how I think things should be done. I'm a terrible team player in that way. I'm not proud of this actually, Brandon. I think this is something that needs to change in me if I want to level up to the next stage of my career is I need to start understanding that there are people who have something to give me that I cannot get unless I serve them. So this goes back to your idea of the servant mindset. Now, everything that we've talked about, I want to start to apply to something that's a little bit out of your wheelhouse, but I want you to imagine for a moment that you're the author now. So you've written your book. The one caveat, and I'm sorry again about the dog, the one caveat that I want to apply here is it's not nonfiction. So the book is not going to help somebody build a business. The book is not going to help somebody create the next Alex Hormozy-like audience. The book itself is the product. It's the terminal product. So like GeoKey, once they have it, they have the thing. There's no next thing. They have the thing. How do you, and I know this is not something that's in your wheelhouse, so whatever you say is fine, but also speaking to somebody outside of this world is really helpful for people who are listening. How do you sell a book that is the product? It is the entertainment. It is the thing. There's no further relationship but this thing.
It's a great question. If it's a product, it's a business. If it's a business, you use the similar methodologies. So you have to understand who's your target market, what's your TAM, your total available market, where do they live, how do they eat, breathe, think, how do they make decisions, and why, you know? And so based off of that, then you go from there. Now, if anybody says to me, and this is any business, yeah, we can do it. We're for everyone. You're going to fail. That's just my first thought. Like, you're going to fail because you're not, and no one is. No one's for everyone. So choosing who is that target market, and then are you selling to them? And this product, it wouldn't be like a service or something. So it's not going to be probably cost oriented. It's about emotion. So how are you going to emotionally grab them to go and take the book and want to read it and spend their time on it? That's something that's really important to understand. Yeah. You know, there's different marketing ways of an approach to do this too, depending on the style, and using digital marketing and in those sense to tell that story. And if it's influencer marketing, you know, you've got somebody who has a following that says, I really enjoy this. That's a good strategy to do that. If you're just capturing through some grand, wild street dance and people are seeing it from there, and they're like, who did this? Oh, is the author of this book. That could be a way of marketing as well. So it just comes down to what is the strategy to get attention. Like, you know, it's like the first chapter, what's my attention getter? And how am I going to pull them in and pull on some heartstrings or emotionally attach them to the book?
Novel marketing is notoriously challenging for the reason that people should fit into categories easily, but they don't. If I have a weight loss product, then I know I'm going after people who feel like they have weight to lose. If I have an electrician's business, then I know I'm going after people who need their electricity repaired or improved or added. You get where I'm going here. Stephen King wrote Carrie. He wrote The Shining. He wrote The Stand. He wrote all of these horror novels. And if you were going to look demographically at people most likely to read horror, they read very, very Republican. I'm going here for a reason. Stephen King is one of the most outspoken Democratic authors out there. He hates Donald Trump so badly that he hasn't been able to write a book without dissing Donald Trump for about a decade now. It's like, it's crazy how much he hates Donald Trump. And I think people know my feelings about Stephen King and how, regardless of his feelings, it has ruined him as an author because he's turned into a preacher rather than a novelist. But the reason I bring this up is because there's something really strange that happens when you try to be a seller of entertainment that it feels, and I might be wrong here, but it feels like all of the wisdom that works for gym owners, whether it's an Anytime Fitness location or people who have nutritional plans or people who are selling lock and key access to hotels and Airbnbs and all of those things. It's not working because you literally spend weeks and months and years thinking about who should be my audience. And your audience can literally be the opposite of a person that you think it is. Are there any examples that you have seen in your life as a business person where you saw, like, if we pivot to this unexpected position, it'll change everything?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, let's
definitely,
hear it.
Definitely done pivots. Okay. You know, I've done business pivots. Well, GLT is a perfect example. We started by selling to gyms, and that's where we were selling the product to. And we were spreading all across the United States, but we weren't making any money. So we had to quickly decide what's another vertical. Well, we were doing padlocks, let's get into manufacturing and utility companies. Mm. We were figuring it out. You know, we charge per active access point or active license. And so it was, and for anybody who doesn't know, we do mobile access control. Yeah. So it was more increasing. And then we stumbled on our first apartment complex and we're like, that's a lot of doors.
Yeah.
A lot of doors in one shot, the bigger bills, and we can solve a huge problem here. So we did that. Once we got into that vertical, they said, well, you need to be tied into our property management system, and you need to be, you needed all these additional links. You need wireless locks and all this. So then we could tailor it to that one vertical. So we pivoted a couple times until eventually we landed on one and then went full bore from sales, marketing, development, everything into it. So that it was tailored around that specific audience, and now we became the superior solution in that experience. So, as we're thinking about it from a book perspective and a novel perspective, I think about books like, like 50 Shades of Grey or Harry Potter, and it's like a sense of escapism with those types of books. Mm-hmm. And it's like, who's trying to escape? What are they trying to escape from?
Yeah.
Why will they just get sucked into this thing?
Oh my God. You just opened up a door I wasn't expecting to go through. I just tweeted out. Can you call it a tweet? I posted on X. I respect what Elon has done. So I've really tried to change my language here, but I'm just so used to Twitter. I posted on X. It's true. I posted on X. Any author, and I'm going to paraphrase here, but any author who writes a novel solely to entertain has failed their readers. There's probably a little bit more to it, but the key words here are solely to entertain and failed. Those are the two things. I really feel strongly that if the only reason you write a novel is to entertain someone, you failed. And so you probably know this about me, but I won't take for granted that you do. Like any novel I write, I want to entertain you. And if I don't entertain you, you're not going to read to the end. So that probably is the primary objective in my mind. But behind the entertaining, when I wrote The Nine Lives of Marva DeLonghi, the big question was, what is it like to be a woman in a man's world? This was now 15 years ago that I started the book. And so like a lot of what has happened in our world now didn't happen 15 years ago. Like it was still very much a man's world. I think that things have started to equalize a little bit, maybe even swing the other way. But at the time I wanted to know, what does it feel like to be a woman? And so I wrote the book and I had a female lead character who was a super badass, like off the rails, drug addicted, like alcoholic, but smarter than hell and really determined woman. And how did men treat her and how did the world treat her and what happened? So that was secondary. I wanted to deliver this very tasty treat and also on the back end of it, teach you something or ask you questions that might lead to learning. The reason I say that is because novels have this really cool opportunity to do multiple things. But when you talk about escapism, and I made that tweet, or that post, people got pissed. People were really angry that I suggested, and they immediately thought that I meant that a novel had to have like some sort of political alignment, which was never my desire. People get real, real angry when you try to get outside of the box. Have you experienced that in your business life where maybe you try to suggest that GeoKey could solve a couple of problems and somebody, or not just GeoKey, but that's the one I'm thinking of, that it could solve problems and then people actually got mad at you for trying to step outside of your lane?
Not in particular, but okay. I would say anything new or different methodology can always be seen as a threat. For example, we're trying to dispose of hard keys. We want to use mobile, your phone. Yeah. For, well, you could think of a thousand reasons why, well, that scares me. That's new. I've never done it before. Yeah. I don't like change. And so introducing, in my opinion, new thoughts, ways of doing things, thought-provoking comments are going to stir up some conversation. And I think conversation is fine. It's healthy. I love, let's have a debate. Let's discuss. Maybe you'll give me the chance to be more clear on where I actually stood. I wasn't trying to make a political statement. I mean, I'm speaking, you know, for you and your tweet or your ex post, whatever we call it. Yeah. I wasn't making a political statement. I'm trying to make a thought-provoking thing that we're not just here for entertainment. I'm trying to make you think of it a different way.
Yeah.
It was misconstrued. That's fine.
Yeah.
This is a big world. And people are going to, you know, morph their own opinions. And I think that's amazing because you just made people think about something, you know, differently. It may not be the direction you wanted it to go.
Yeah.
But I do think when you do that and you initiate that thought, that's where change starts and innovation begins. And that's when you see a brighter future. And I think once you think of it in those terms, it's pretty beautiful.
Art in and of itself is a unique beast because it already requires us to be interested in the thing produced, right? So it's kind of like, I like a sauna, but if I don't enjoy heat, I'm not a customer for the sauna, right? But for the population that likes sauna, how do I figure out how to distinguish myself from all of the other sauna producers out there? And I'm asking this question as vaguely as I can, because I know that you have done an amazing job of building a company in GeoKey that is competitively involved with other companies that are doing something similar. So I want to hear you talk a little bit about what are the kind of things that GeoKey does to distinguish itself, and how would that apply to art?
Yeah, I love that. I mean, I like that sauna example. It's like there's people making saunas, but you know, how are you going to do a difference who doesn't like heat? And we had to take that same methodology, not only to the multifamily space, where GeoKey plays, but we had to do it with access control, because we're like two businesses in one. We're an access control business in multifamily. So you have to learn both of them. And then your nuances and how do you differentiate yourselves in both. So like for us, in the access control space, we don't do credentialing within the hardware components. We do it within the phone. So where traditionally the market has been so focused on the best hardware there could be, we said, don't you have a supercomputer in your pocket? Can't that be the key? And that there was like, oh yeah, I guess it could. So what does that mean then? It means no readers, and it means no Wi-Fi, managed Wi-Fi throughout a facility. Well, that'll save me $100,000+. Bingo. And then on the multifamily front, it was like, you know, they're dollars and cents oriented. And it was like, okay, you don't need the managed Wi-Fi. We're going to have all these integrations for you so that you can pick and choose, and you can do it in an affordable way. So you get what all the competitors are doing at a low cost barrier to entry. And so that's been our approach. And in that market, you know, can we go do a luxury high rise apartment? Yeah. Do we do student housing and garden style apartments better? Absolutely. And so that's what we focus on. If you have a class B, class A suburban apartment or a student housing apartment, multifamily apartment, we are your solution. And then even narrowing it down to say, okay, we picked a market, which was multifamily. No, we picked a market within multifamily and one or two. And that's the way people got to think about things. Because I think we get caught up in our worlds and thinking the world is smaller than it is. And it, you know, and it can be through certain lenses, but when it comes to sales, it's like your example of a 10% of a million or 100% of zero. I would rather take this smaller TAM, a total available market, and get a larger majority of it than trying to shotgun shell approach a larger market and getting a smaller percentage. So tailoring even past the tailored point is key. And then you after you master that, then you can diversify. But it is a noisy world out here. It is noisy and it's so very competitive. Noisy. And there's so many smart people that are doing amazing things. And to differentiate yourself and to stand out in a world where you can get your name out through any avenue from podcast to Facebook to Google to whatever it may be, how are you going to do it? Well, you got to do it by talking to a select group, in my opinion.
Yeah. A question I think that stacks on really well here is there are people out there, I have experienced them, you have experienced them, who have a really high opinion of what they're able to do versus what they're actually doing. So I'd love to know, like, when is the moment? How do you qualify the person you're talking to? Does that make sense what I'm asking?
Yeah, it does. And I actually have a different little spin on it.
Great.
And this comes from running a software company. When you run a software company and someone says, can you do this? Your natural instincts are to go, yes, we can, and figure it out later.
Yeah, that's always me. That's always me.
Yeah, yeah.
Literally.
Figure it out. And in some cases, like on smaller things, like that's okay. But if you take the opportunity to be honest and go, we actually can't do that today. But it doesn't mean we can't do that in the future. I'd like to understand from you why you want that. And not only that, is that the only thing as a non-negotiable on your list? And is that into other things? And what is a non-negotiable now? And what's going to be a non-negotiable later? And in that approach, you will find, you will get so many answers to success.
Wow.
Just through honesty, rather than faking it till you make it to make it.
Oh my gosh. I love that answer so, so much. And especially the way that you framed it, which is, I think that many of us, and I know for myself, fake it till you make it, has brought a lot of destruction. So people who listen to the show probably know that my stepmom was a elite executive senior sales director for Mary Kay Cosmetics. And like one of the big things that she always talked about was fake it till you make it. I learned how to sell from her. I'll be completely honest. I learned how to be the kind of person who can sell. I also learned how to differentiate my shyness from how to sell. And for those two things, I'm really grateful. However, I absolutely believe what you just said is the reason that she no longer works for Mary Kay, is that like when you get to the point where fake it till you make it is no longer the answer, then what do you have left in the gas tank? I'd love to hear from you about how do you know you have something great to offer?
When people start buying. No, I mean, you're gonna, market validation is the key, right? And I half jokingly, but kind of serious, mean that. It's like when you start having some paying clients and you have people who are believing it and they're like, this is great. And not just saying this is great. It's like, no, this is great enough for me to want to spend my resources on this. Then there's another point that happens after that. Because if it's building a product or a service or everything, you're going to have your base, which is like your MVP. It's your, or in the service, whatever, minimal viable product or service.
Yep.
And this is enough to get people to buy it. But there is going to be versions. What are things we need to add and so on? And so if that's not going to be enough, there's going to be more that the market wants. And this is such a quickly evolving time. And because of technology, and that's on across all industries. And so you have to keep up and you have to keep, improving and understanding what does the market want, or predicting what the market needs and wants by just listening. R&D, research and development is key.
Yeah. Let's drill down. I love what you're saying. So let's take our minimum viable product and let's apply it to the people who are listening to the podcast right now, which many of them are authors who have written a novel. There is a moment inside of the novel writing in which you are literally listening to yourself, tell yourself that what you're doing is worth your time. And probably the biggest pitfall for novelists is believing that they're doing shit. And so they quit. But for those who continue and they get to the end and they've written this novel that's great, it's a piece of art. It is, again, we talked about this earlier, the terminal product in and of itself. The novel itself is what we're going to sell. So let's assume that we can sell it for $6.99, because I think that's a reasonable amount of money for a digital product. There's a 0% cost once you sell it for $6.99, or you can sell it physically for maybe $18.99 and it costs you $5 to print. So it's about the same amount of money, regardless of your route. But you have your minimum viable product. You're going out to market. You're getting some success, but maybe you're not getting the level of success. How do you start to twist, tweak, and build your pitch to the point where you start to reach A, the people that need to hear your message, and B, the people who are willing to spend money to hear your message? Feel free to ask any questions if there's not a total clarity in that question.
No, there is. I understand what you're saying. So one thing you need to analyze is who's buying, and understand what that group is and why they bought. And so doing case studies internally to say, hey, you bought my book. How did it make you feel? What did you think through that process? What was like the striking moments to you? If you had to go tell somebody about this book, what would you say? Take that and make that into a marketing message. And I think if you are an author and you poured your blood, sweat, tears, cash, everything into something, just like growing a business or painting a masterpiece, whatever it may be, there is so much of your emotions and ego tied up into that.
Yeah.
And that right there can be your biggest pitfall. Because what you need to understand is, what is the end goal here? Is my end goal to be the largest novelist in the world? Is my goal to change some lives? Is my goal to make people happy? And I don't care how it gets. You have to understand what that looks like first.
Okay.
And then knowing on what that looks like, that's where you have to check your ego.
Let's stop here real quick. I know you have more to say, but I want to stop here because I think it's such an important thing that you just said is, first off, what's your goal? What do you want for GeoKey? Do you want to change lives? Do you want to change the world? Do you want to unseat Elon Musk? Like, where do you see yourself?
Yeah, I want to change the way people live. I want to change the way people access their homes. I want them to be secure and I want it to be simple. And I think we can do that with the technology we have today. Now, from the very beginning, when we built our MVP product, if I said it worked flawlessly all the time, I'd be lying.
Yeah.
People would say to me, this app sucks.
Wow. Yeah.
And that hurts. And you're like, dang. And so in that moment, you have two options. One, to go, no, you suck. I'm doing the best I can. Or you can say, why? Can you tell me why? Help me. I want to improve this thing. I want this to be the best experience you've ever had. What would you do?
What a beautiful place to dig in here too. Sorry, forgive me for interrupting. You're hitting a point where it's really, really important for artists. So there's a split fork right here. And the fork is, I know for sure that what I have created is right versus how can I adapt? And a lot of us will assume that those two things are binary, that you either have to say like, F you, I'm not going to change what I've done because it's art and it's beautiful and it's perfect. And, you know, screw you for not getting my mission. And then there's other people who realize that like the reader really matters. And so they say like, what can I change to make this more enjoyable? What you just said was so, so important because you basically said like, I've created this thing, either like come with me or how can I change? How do you parse those two things? How do you decide like when is the moment to hold on tight to the vision versus how can I change the vision to get where I'm going?
Mm-hmm. Not by putting all of your weight into one opinion.
Yeah. So even your own opinion?
Your own opinion is part of the opinions. You have your own opinion. You have your own thoughts. You are the director. You're the boss. You're the puppet master of this whole situation. And are you going to run this puppet into the ground, or is it going to, you know, fly and flourish? And so what you do is you go, I got it to this. Now I need help to get it to that point. So what I'm going to go do is I'm going to go get 20, 30, 50 opinions.
Mm.
And I'm going to compile those opinions, and then I'm going to make a decision as the puppeteer.
Okay. Who do you decide is worth an opinion versus who's not worth an opinion?
Well, I think every opinion is worth listening to. But it's what you do after the opinion is up to you. I think you should listen to all opinions.
Yeah.
I want to see upside down every angle that people are looking through this thing, because I know that no person is alike. The way they see, taste, look, think, everyone does it differently. So in one of these things, I might hear 50 hours worth of opinions, but there was 2 minutes of epiphany that happened that completely changed the course. And that's the reality of the situation. And it's on you and your discernment to be able to parse this out. This is what differentiates a good business owner or an artist from a non.
Mm.
I couldn't grow a company by myself. I can only get it to a certain amount. At some point, that's I'm going to rely on other people to come help with the success. But at the end of the day, I'm still the chief executive officer.
Yeah, listen, that's what you're saying is absolutely fascinating, because I think that it flies in the face of a lot of artists. Most artists believe, and this applies to whether you're a visual artist, doing film, writing, music, anything else. Most artists believe that their sole opinion is what determines anything that's good or not. And I have met so many artists, and I have been the artist who has said before that if you don't agree with my mission, then you're stupid. And I'm being very blunt in the way I describe it, because I think it's really important to understand what you just said is most likely the distinction between why classical businesses succeed and artists fail, is that there has to be room and allowance for us to be a voice, not the voice. Is that something that came natural to you, Brandon, or do you feel like you learned it through failure? What's the blend that allowed you to understand that, like, a symphony of voices was how you would succeed?
Well, I have a longer answer for that one. So I'm going to go back to one thing you just said, and you said it's the mission. And I think clearly defining what that mission is your mission that what I wrote today is it. It's it. I don't need opinions.
Yeah.
Or is your mission, I think that I'm 98% there, and that my mission is to get this novel into these stores sell this many. Like, what is that mission? Until you can clearly define what that actually is, it's kind of like what I said about us selling to multifamily. It's like, we had to pick one.
Yeah.
It's like, you have to understand where you're going. So from there. So to answer your other question on the opinions of others, I know my skill sets. I know what I'm good at. And I like very heavy into those things. But I also know there's a whole other world out there that I don't know. I want to know. I have a thirst for education. And that can look in so many different facets. But I'm like, I want to know. And teach me. Like, and thoroughly, like, really show interest. So when you talk to somebody, you're like, why is that? Why? How? Yeah. How did you get into that? Why is it like this? And it's like a child. It's like a childlike interest. And these people who pour their hearts and souls into something are like, you're actually interested in what I'm saying? No one cares about what I say, you know, most of the time. It's like, no, I'm truly like, tell me more. And they're like, and you just watch me fired up. And they're just like, oh my gosh, well, there's this and this and this. And you reach a moment of a light bulb moment, and you go, thank you so much, because you just changed a huge part of my life. And this goes back to the first podcasts, which is they'll go, thank you so much for caring about what I had to say. That meant a lot to me. This was a fun conversation for me. I get to talk about something that I work really hard at. And so that's where that balance comes into play. So if you truly have a thirst for education, learning, and understanding, and you can set your ego aside for a moment and say, you know what, I'm really not the smartest person, but that doesn't mean I'm the dumbest person.
Yeah.
It means I want to be the smartest person. And to my opinion, that means I am the smartest person. So if you can switch your mindset to that, you will scale, you will elevate, and you'll just be every single month, every single day, you'll just be a little bit newer, better, stronger, faster, smarter person.
Yeah.
And I believe that.
So people like Alex Hormozi, even Stephen Pressfield, like I could just do such a long list of folks who will tell you that talent will get you a certain part of the way. Determination will get you a little bit further. So you have to have talent. And when I say talent, I mean, like, I think that when we talked last time, you admitted you couldn't play in the NBA. You're kind of short. I'll admit it. You're kind of a short guy.
True.
Yeah, it is. And so you're most likely not going to play in the NBA. Talent, how you're built, and some other things are going to get you to the line. And most of us who are listening at some point in our schooling career played dodgeball. So there are balls that are lined up along the neutral zone, and you're back on the back wall, and they're going to say, like, 3, 2, 1, go. You're all going to run as hard as you can. And talent and size and all of the things we just talked about are going to determine who gets those balls. However, there's also this other element that I think is really important that we don't talk a lot about, and it's called luck. So in luck, the tallest, fastest, most talented kid, like just the best, trips and doesn't make it to the ball. Somebody who's short and not successful and not skilled gets to that ball because the tall one fell. There's a level of skill that is involved here. There's also something else, and I want you to talk about both these things. So pin it in your head right now that luck is part of this journey, but also pin it that who you know is part of it. And the reason I say that is because if you're playing dodgeball, all those kids who run, some of them have bad luck and they don't get there. Some of them have good luck and they do get there. But once you grab a ball and you're going to throw it, there's people on the side of the battlefield that you care about and you want them to care about you. And so you actually target a less well-known person. I'm interested to hear from you about luck and connections. Those are the two things I think that are seemingly out of our control, but I don't believe are actually out of our control. Talk to me about that part of the game.
Well, I think there's a lot of dimensions to luck and how those things are, but I would say probably the biggest one to me is John Maxwell's 21 Irrefutable Laws of Leadership. He talks about the law of attraction. And, you know, you hear people talk about, show me your friends and I'll show you your future, those types of things. And I know some of these are cliches, but the reality of the situation is that if you're naturally a positive person, a caring person, a serving person, I think the world works in a way that it will return favors to you. I've seen it time and time again. And the friendships I've had and the people I respect. I've got a really good mentor. And one of the things he talks about a lot is relationships matter. Mm-hmm. You know, and this is a super intelligent guy. He's a Marine. Yeah. He's a Marine. You know, worked in Fortune 500 companies, C-level executive, and he talks about relationships matter. That's the number one thing he says. But the guy is wicked smart, hardworking, and all these things. But that's his number one. And it's so interesting, and it's to your point right now. It's like, yeah, I perfected my determination and my skill sets. I bust my tail on a daily basis. But that doesn't matter unless the opportunities present themselves. And when that opportunity presents itself, am I ready to play? Can I take that moment, capitalize on it, and make it a success point for me? And that, to me, is the definition of luck.
Interesting. Okay. I mean, I like that. I have to think on it. I have to think on it a little bit. I agree with you. I think that that's a really profound and powerful piece of the puzzle. Knowing people is really important.
And optimism. I think optimism is key.
Yes.
You go through your life, you know, and that's kind of the relationships matter side of things. And how do you make relationships? Well, you don't do it by being an asshole or being, you know, negative all the time. You do it because you're positive in the law of attraction type of scenario. It's like, I want to be near that person. Not only do I want to be near that person, I kind of want to do something for that person because I feel like that's going to get reciprocated through what they do and what they've already are doing for me and what I've seen from other people. And it's not because that person is like, I'm being nice because I want something on the back end. I don't donate to charities because I want something returned to me or what have you. It's because I have a servant heart, and that's what I put on this earth to do. And that's my DNA.
What's so compelling about what you're talking about? So, I think you know, in fact, I know you know this. We talked about it at a holiday where we got together. I have a company called SPSE, Self-Published Author Cooperative. And what I'm really uniquely qualified to do is to make cold calls. I'm very good at it. I pick up the phone. I talk to people. I understand how to get them to talk to me. And I also am almost indestructible in terms of like being hung up on and made fun of. So I'm really good at this piece of the business. And so I'm calling bookstores and I'm saying, I've got this group of authors and they're really best-selling authors and we're going to do great. Would you like to buy 25 books with SPSE? And, you know, we have some success. What is actually really, really difficult about what I'm doing is not selling the bookstores. I sell bookstores fairly easily. It's a percentage game for me. Like, I'm going to call 20 bookstores and one in 20 is going to say yes. And that is a good conversion rate as far as I know. But what's actually difficult is once I have the bookstore online, I need to get the next month of books going so that by the time that we have done month one, they're ready for five new authors. And what I've been really surprised about is how hard it is to get authors to agree. And this has something to do with luck and it has something to do with prowess or reputation. So I called a couple of, I didn't even call. I Facebook messaged a couple of people today who are far more successful than I am, but they're authors that are in my queue already. And I said, we're failing. We are not going to make it forward unless we can figure out how to get more authors involved. I need your input. So these are very successful people who are going to come to me and say, this is what you need to do. The second author, Jonathan Yanez, identified for me, well, your podcast is for people who are just getting going and you're running an ad for people who are selling a million books a year. How do you think that anyone's going to sign up for a program when your podcast doesn't actually cater to those people? I'm really interested in this piece of the luck and this piece of the message. How do you find people to move you forward? Because that is reach. And that's one thing you didn't speak to as much is, how do you use your reputation? How do you climb? How do you decide when it's, I know I'm asking a lot of questions. I'm building a constellation. How do you decide when it's time to leave behind people who aren't going where you're going, that were good for a moment? And all of that stuff, like this building is so difficult. Who goes with you?
It's a loaded question.
I know. I'm sorry.
You're fine. It's that's tough. You know, that's tough, but in that scenario, it's talking, you know, it's tailoring to what that is. It's picking one thing and being a master in it. And to the audiences, it's like, you know, this is where we're at. This is what we're doing. This is what we're talking about. And it's helping this select group of people. And that has to be transferable on all fronts. And to be able to communicate that, I mean, as we got into the multifamily world, we started selling our mobile security to small retail businesses. And it wasn't until we got into our first apartment, convinced them, and it was like, oh my gosh, we're having this is like super big success here. Like, we make more money off these. There's more opportunities out here. The sales are bigger, so we can do less. Let's start building our technology around the sales, marketing, support, development. We did it all towards around this. And then we got invested in a company out of Chicago who has 20,000 apartment units that invested in us. And then they started putting us in theirs. And then we could go to the market and say, this company not only was a client, but they liked us so much they invested in us.
Wow.
Well, that's not enough for you to understand that this is the direction to go. This is the direction to go. And nobody likes to be first. No one likes to be first. They want to be, it was proven, and then we'll go from there. There's a few. There is the early adopters, right, that are like, I'll be first. But listen, I'm not going to pay you. I'll give you great advice. I'm not going to pay you. And right. It's like, okay, you need them too. But as you evolve and you change and you listen and you be agile, because what you'll do is, and this is kind of to the luck conversation, is you're going to stumble on what that target market is, or the focus, or the sales channel, or whatever it may be that's like the doorway to your success. You're going to stumble on it. But you have to have the discernment to recognize that and go shut everything out and focus only on this. There's a book called The 10X is Better Than 2X. And they talk about
who wrote that again? Remind me.
It is Dan Sullivan.
Perfect. Okay.
Dan Sullivan.
As a quick aside, is 10X Grant Cardone? Is Grant Cardone the one who invented like the 10X principle?
I think 10X has been around for a long time. I don't know if he trademarked it or not, but
I don't think trademarked it. I just want to see. Like, I'm curious. So you looked it up. Keep talking, and I'm going to tell you when he published it. So I'm really curious. I love Grant Cardone. I think he's a jackass, and I certainly could not work for him. But I love him. You know, 10X the
respect the grind.
Go for it. Yeah.
You know, he's a media guy now, though.
Yeah, I know.
when you think about the book, 10X is better than 2X, what they tell you is that they to scale up to get to the next, you have to remove 80% of the noise, 80% of the BS. Well, I want to be everything to everybody and I have to do this. Forget it. Do the 20%, because the 20% will, if you just focus on that, will get you 100% of your growth. Yeah. And so that's a hard thing. Like, when you think about it, it's like, oh, that makes sense. It's like, yeah, but do it then.
Yeah.
Let go of those other things. Just say no to them. It's like, well, that might hurt this person, or I'll burn this bridge, or these people are like, I'll lose that business. They're paying clients. Doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You have to take that leap of faith and that jump. And that's what I'm talking about, is when luck shows itself and you have to walk through that door, you better not leave one foot out. You walk through that door. And it's a risk. It all is.
Huge.
But that's the world of success. You have to take the risks. And that's why entrepreneurship, being an author, taking these like steps of like changing your own destiny, it's like, that's why it's hard. That's why people don't do it. It's because it gets to that inflection point where it's like, I have to make a decision here.
Yeah.
Yes, you do. Yes, you do.
So Alex Hormozi is a really big advocate of like, burn all the bridges, sleep in the gym, do the thing. Grant Cardone is probably somewhere in that same universe of like, leave yourself no retreat. There's also people like Cody Sanchez who will continue to work a lucrative job and build as they're going. I'm really curious, and I actually can't answer this question. I can't even approach this question because I'm not here yet. I feel a little bit like, in a sense, so you are currently, if I'm correct, and correct me if I'm wrong, CEO of DPA, but you're also
the founder of GeoKey. So you've got a couple of businesses going, and if one of them failed, like, you have a fallback. I want to hear from you in closing about, like, should you burn the bridges? When do you decide that no retreat is the only way forward? Love you.
Oh my gosh, you're always throwing your balls at me. That's a great question. I mean, okay, Grandpa, I'm third gen at DPA, and Grandpa always said, and I'm sure Ashley, your wife, has brought this up before, but he always said the only thing you could be married to is your wife and the business and all of that. And I don't think he meant that in a way of, like, when the going gets tough, quit. I think what he said in that is that your mission should be bigger than the company. Your mission should be bigger than what you're trying, you know, what just the profit that you're trying to do. If you're just doing it, you know, if write the book for a profit, or if you're trying to grow the company for a profit, and it's not a bigger thing, you're going to burn out. It's going to fall down.
Yeah.
So you have to understand that first and foremost. The other thing, as the leader of the company, you have to understand that whoever you bring along with you is they're your responsibility too. They are responsibilities to do your expectations, but they are a part of your mission, and now they become a part of your responsibility.
Yeah.
And so I don't think there's ever a point where it's like retreat, but you should always be looking at the point of pivot, and I need to reallocate this into a new direction to protect my mission or the people that are fighting with my mission.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. At the end of the day, you know, I don't see, like, either one of the companies like, oh, if this one fails, I have a fallback. It's like, okay, I'm always going to put things in place to ensure that we never have that fallback. Risk mitigation plans, the right people in the right seats. You know, as a CEO, and everyone's a CEO of their own life. Every single person is.
Right.
I had a mentor that said to me, the job of the CEO is to grow the company and protect the company.
Yeah.
But if you're not growing and protecting, you're not doing your job. So if you see this a lot in people who start having a lot of success, they get fat and happy, and they get kick my feet up, you know, and all that kind of stuff. It's like, oh, okay, so your mission was the profits. What is your mission? And is it something bigger? Is it something greater? Is it something that gives you happiness? It gives you fulfillment, because the going is going to get tough. You are going to get a point where you're getting kicked in the shorts, and you're going to have to make the hard decision to keep going, or to pivot, or to just, you know, make the right decision. And emotions can't get in the way. Ego can't get in the way. You have to do what's right.
Yeah.
And so that would be my answer to your question.
Last question. You need a person in your world who has accomplished a great deal more than you have. You're not related to them. You're not friends with them. You don't know them. How do you get that person to respond to your outreach?
What are you wanting from them?
Okay.
That'd be my first question. Why are you outreaching? Are you because you want something, or because you want to make a relationship? I would start with a relationship.
Yeah. I love your answer. I love your answer. And I also, like, I love your answer. I agree with your answer. And I also still want to ask you the question, how do you get them to respond? Because maybe it's all of those things. I happen to, out of very good luck, have a friendship with a Pulitzer Prize winning novelist. And I never use him for anything that I probably should. But he would respond to me. It's literally like I've got a guy in my pocket who could solve a lot of my problems, and I won't use him because I'm afraid of making him feel like he's been used. But I want to know, for all of those people out there who are just really looking to get connected to the next level, like, what do you do?
Have you heard of the term, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink?
Unless you make them thirsty enough, and then the chances that they will drink are high enough that you can make
them drink.
Yes, I have.
I think that's slim, but yes. So I think that the relationship of somebody like that, yes, they can walk you through the door, but it's like having kids. It's like, can I just tie your shoes for you? But you're never going to be able to tie your shoes 100 times that I need you to do.
Well said.
So I'm going to spend the time to teach you how to tie your shoes.
Well said.
I think people ask the wrong questions. I think it's instant gratification. I want you to walk me through that door. And somebody who's already went through the journey, they don't respect that. What they respect is you went through the same challenges. I was in your shoes too. I didn't have anything. I came from scraps. And so what they want to do, and that's where the relationship starts, is what's so gratifying to them is to watch you not make the bad decisions that they made and be a success. Because a lot of those people are like, okay, if I made an extra $1 million a year, is it going to change my life? No, I'm fine. I have four houses. You know, right? You know, it's like, yeah. You know, my point, it's probably a little dramatic, but you know what I mean? It's like,
no, not at all.
They want to know. It's like, so stop asking the wrong questions. Hey, can you get me this? No. Hey, can I spend time with you just to hear your story? 15 minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes. I'd love to just hear your story because I feel that I am on the same journey as you of when you were at this, because I just admire you and I've studied you. And I want to learn so that I someday can be like you. And 20 minutes of your time would change my world. And that's all I ask.
Thank you for listening to TRBM. The theme music was provided by the ever-talented Christopher Talon. And hey, if you liked what you heard, share this show with other readers, because what's the point of telling stories if nobody's listening?